All right, good morning, everybody. Tuesday morning, April 12th, 11:15 a.m. We're doing Chem 12A lecture, and I was just looking at where I left off. Let me do a screen share, and we can pick it up. Wait, basic cable, that should do it. Maybe, yes. All right, so last lecture, what we were looking at was really looking at this reaction theory. This idea of working from the nucleophile that has the electron density, and these are the highest occupied molecular orbital electrons, and how they fall into the LUMO level of the electrophile. And that is almost all chemical reactions. Almost all chemical reactions work exactly the same way. It's always from the highest occupied molecular orbital to the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. And the rate of the chemical reaction, the speed of the chemical reaction can be affected by the difference between these two levels and tuning it, so to speak, to make sure that those electrons are falling to the lower level. And so then the question becomes, or what the question is that we were asking is, what does that LUMO look like? And how does that LUMO affect the way in which this reaction goes forward? So we said that there were two ways to look at that LUMO. One of them was to go through and look at valence bonding theory. Valence bonding theory gave us an idea of what that LUMO looked like. We had the bonding orbital and the unoccupied antibonding orbital. That is the LUMO level. And so that LUMO puts a electron density over here on the backside of the carbon, or I should say not electron density, but the orbital, puts the orbital on the backside of the carbon. And then molecular orbital theory even does it a little bit better, because what molecular orbital theory shows us is that when I look at that antibonding orbital, that LUMO, and the picture of that LUMO, and this one, I can't do this hand waving addition, subtraction sort of dealy bob. This one, we just have to rely on the computer to calculate the molecular orbital theory for us. In this one, what we see is that the highest coefficient, the largest coefficient, meaning the largest orbital, happens to be directly behind where the carbon halogen bond is, or where the carbon leaving group bond is. And that largest coefficient orbital, the largest orbital, is basically the bullseye, is what the nucleophile has to attack in order to break that bond. So we did a little ditty here about looking at why bonds are made in the first place, that energy comes down as we add electron density into the bonding orbital. But then when we stick electron density into an antibonding orbital, the bond breaks. And so this is the reason, this is the emphasis of needing to stick electron density into that antibonding orbital, because it actually causes the breaking of the sigma bond. And so there's two components there. There is the component where I have to hit the backside in the antibonding orbital, because that's the largest target, and that's the way that this bond gets disrupted. And that breaks the sigma bond of the carbon leaving group. And we go through this transition state, which is sort of a linear transition state, in that I have the incoming nucleophile, the outgoing leaving group, and that the carbon is almost pentavalent. And at that point, I have attachment to both the incoming nucleophile, which is partial minus, and the leaving group, which is partial minus. So that's where we left it off. Must attack at the backside. And that's where we pick it up today. So is that backside attack? And what we want to know, what we want to pick up with today, is we want to look at the nature of this transition state and what this transition state really looks like, and what it can tell us about how this reaction goes forward, and how we can control this reaction. So let's pick it up there, and let's do a new note. This is substitution nucleophilic. We're in chapter 7, and we're still looking at SN2 reactions. And our question really is here, what is the nature of this transition state? So I'm gonna do it this way, where I'm looking at a specific incoming nucleophile in a specific leaving group. And they're on a methyl group here. And this is my transition state. And the question is, what does this transition state look like? That's the first question. Second question might be what can that transition state tell us about the rate of this chemical reaction? So there's a couple of questions that we would like to answer. And when we want to know what that transition state looks like, what we need to do is we need to go back to the energy diagram. So if we take and we build an energy diagram quickly, and we say, all right, this is my starting material where I have the incoming nucleophile, which is negatively charged. I have the methyl bromide as my substrate. And then I'm going to go through that transition state and come out to products. And as I come out to products, I'm going to have the dimethyl ether. And the bromide ion that has been kicked out. And now I'm really interested in this transition state that's going on here. So this is partial minus. And let's put the hydrogens in there too. Okay, so how can I get more information on the actual nature of that transition state? Well, what I could do is I could submit it to computation and I could go do a transition state search and actually find what that transition state looks like. But we have other powerful tools here that we don't need to go to that extent to actually get that information, at least not at this level that we really need. We can look at the Hammond postulate. So the Hammond postulate is going to tie these guys together. It's going to tie the side that is closest in energy to the transition state. And what it says is that the transition state will resemble the side that it is closest in energy to. So that means that this is going to be reactant-like. So the transition state in this setup, transition state is reactant-like. And being reactant-like, now we've got a better idea of what this transition state looks like. So now I can say for certain that the incoming nucleophile is farther away from the carbon. The carbon is a little bit more tetrahedral, not fully tetrahedral, but a little bit more tetrahedral. And this bromide bond is not fully dissociated. This is more reactant-like. And I have a very large partial minus on that incoming nucleophile. And I have a smaller partial minus on the bromide. And that this is reactant-like. Meaning that it's an early transition state. So given that that is an early transition state, the early transition state tells me that anything that is affecting the energy of this side is going to also affect the energy of the transition state. That's the important key. So the key component here is that anything that raises the energy of the reactants also raises the energy of the transition state. And so that means now that we can make some predictions on this. And of course, if you raise the energy of the transition state, that implies that it is going to raise the activation energy for the reaction. And that in turn will slow the reaction down. So what kind of things are going to raise the energy of that starting material? Well, as this group is coming in, it's coming in and it's attacking a tetrahedral center here, or a mostly tetrahedral center. And as one thing gets close to another, we start to run into sterics. So we've talked about sterics before. We understand what sterics are. So steric impact. When the incoming nucleophile is approaching a tetrahedral center, the more sterics there are around that tetrahedral center, the higher in activation energy that the system is going to be. So if I take a look at this and I say, all right, I look at a methyl group versus a primary versus a secondary versus a tertiary, that I can predict what's going to happen to the activation energy of the transition state. So one way to draw that is to say that let's look at a methyl. We'll put a leaving group on here and we'll come in with the nucleophile. This will have the hydrogens. This will be a methyl substrate. And in terms of activation energy, what we see is that this is our baseline for activation energy. And that the E sub A that is here in the transition state, let's say that this is baseline because this is the lowest amount of sterics that we can have. Let's increase the sterics and see what happens to it. So now when we increase the sterics, we're going to go to a primary substrate, different than a methyl in that in a primary substrate, I may have, let's not say a methyl group, but let's put an R group there. Meaning that it could be any carbon group that is there and the leaving group and the incoming nucleophile. Now as that incoming nucleophile is here, it starts to see sterics from that R group. This is now a primary substrate. The primary substrate increases the activation energy over what was the baseline. So if I take this and I say, all right, this was my methyl, and I want to style this maybe in a dotted line, then what's going to happen here is that the increase in energy is going to be on this side. And the energy now of the methyl group goes up. Excuse me, it's not methyl, it's now primary. Ah, coming back. Technical difficulties. And we come down to essentially the same energy. But what has happened is, as we have increased the energy of the starting material, we've also increased the energy of the activation that for this chemical reaction. And this is going to slow this reaction down. So the reaction becomes more energetically costly for the reaction to actually go forward. And that continues to happen as we look at primary to secondary to tertiary. And so now what's happening is the E sub A is larger. This is larger E sub A. This means that the reaction is a slower reaction. The reaction costs more energy for the reaction to actually go forward. And if we look at that and we go to a secondary substrate, so that now we have two R groups on here. In the incoming nucleophile. Now I've got sterics that are building in multiple locations, making it more difficult for the nucleophile to reach that backside attack. Again, what winds up happening is we have an increase in activation energy that just makes the reaction more expensive. It takes more energy in order to make it go. And then if we go to a carbon that is now a tertiary substrate, now there's lots of sterics. And this can be so much sterics that the reaction can't even take place. This can completely shut the reaction down as we go to a tertiary substrate. And other energetic pathways will become more favorable because the SN2 reaction has shut down. So we'll say this is too large for reaction to be favorable. So what we see in terms of this rate of this chemical reaction is that our rate based on substrate is that primaries are much faster than secondaries, which are much faster than tertiaries. And so we favor really that primary substrate or methyl substrate. Methyl is really limiting. Usually what we say is primary because we're not working on a methyl group very often, but we're very often working on a primary substrate. And that rate favoring the primary substrate has to do with sterics around the center, and that it just makes it harder for the nucleophile to attack that tertiary center if there's too much sterics there. And as I said, other pathways then become more favorable. So that's an overview of the SN2 reaction. There's a lot more to do with SN2, but we're going to wait until we come back with an overview of all the general reactions to put even a little bit more data to this. But for right now, we're going to leave the SN2 reaction and we're going to take and look at an SN1 reaction, and we'll come back together and compare these in a little bit. So hang on to this idea of this Hammond postulate, and the idea of what's going on here is that as I continue to raise this energy up, and I can take this guy as the baseline, we can just keep putting it back in here and showing. I think I can style it this way. I'll do the same thing here. That the idea here is that what we're doing is we're increasing both the starting position and the activation energy. and that is just continuing to increase as I go from primary to secondary to tertiary. So there's sort of an overall view of what's going on and how that's changing from that methyl baseline energy diagram. And that concept that whichever side is closest in energy, whichever side the transition state is closest in energy to, that whatever affects the energy of that side will also affect the energy of the transition state. That is the key component of what we're trying to do with Hammond postulate. Okay, let's take it from there. And let's go take a look at SN1. So SN1 is substitution nucleophilic first order. And as we're looking at a first order reaction, what happens in this case is that the R group with the leaving group, in this case, the leaving group spontaneously pops off. It leaves behind a carbocation. The carbocation is then subsequently, in a second step, attacked by the nucleophile that makes the new bond. And this makes our nucleophile plus leaving group that has come off as minus. So overall, when you look at the reaction, if you just skip over how this reaction is actually taking place, it looks like a substitution reaction. In fact, it is. It's a substitution reaction. The nucleophile replaces the leaving group, but it's the way in which the nucleophile replaces the leaving group that this is a two-step process in terms of this happening. So energy diagram-wise, when we look at an energy diagram for this reaction, we have a starting energy for the system. We have an activation energy that goes to an intermediate. The intermediate sits here. And then we have a small activation energy and the formation of a product. Just doesn't want to snap in for me, but will. There we go. And this is our overview of an SN1. So what we have is we have our leaving group. The nucleophile is hanging out and is part of this energy calculation as well. So everything that's in the starting materials side, everything that's in the reactant side has to be there in terms of energy. The nucleophile is still hanging out. The leaving group has now left. And I'm primarily looking at the energy of that carbocation. And this is an intermediate. It's not a transition state. The transition states, there are two of them at these points here. Then the nucleophile comes in and binds to this, and I get the nucleophile bound to the R group, and the leaving group is now the anion. So if you remember in terms of your chemical reactions, the step that has the largest activation energy is what we call the rate determining step. So RDS equals rate determining step. The other activation energy is fairly small. And so this step over here, this is the fast step, does not really impact the rate. The rate is impacted in the first step with the loss of the leaving group. And so what we're really curious about is, what does that thing look like? This is what we want to see, is what does that transition state look like? And how is that transition state affected? That's where we're going to spend our time in a little bit. Okay, so the rate of this chemical reaction is equal to some rate constant times the concentration of only our leaving group. Because it's a unimolecular reaction, it is a first order rate law. It only depends on the concentration of a single species, the leaving group. And for this reaction, what we're going to see is that the rate based on substrate is going to go tertiary is far faster than secondary, which is faster than primary. So this has the absolute reverse rate of the SN2 reaction. We'll have to take a look at why. So let's see some examples first of how these reactions look, and then we will do a deeper dive into this reaction mechanism and investigate what that transition state looks like and how do we impact this reaction, what's going on here. So some examples. Examples might look like a tertiary chloride reacting in the solvent of acetic acid, usually with heat. This goes and forms an ester where I have replacement by solvent, and the HCl was the byproduct out of that chemical reaction. We can see these reactions where I have different groups. Let's see. It can happen as an internal reaction. I can just add some heat to this, and this thing can go forward and can make wrong spot there. This guy plus HOTS. TS stands for tosylate. So when I'm looking at this group, what the tosylate group is let me show what this molecule looks like and how we abbreviate this. I'll show another example. O bound to a sulfur. That sulfur has two double bonded oxygens connected to it. And then it also has an aromatic ring and a methyl group. And this group is abbreviated as OTS. It stands for tosylate. And they are extremely good leaving groups. Same thing over here, this HOTS. This is the protonated form of the leaving group, just as HCl was the protonated form of the chloride leaving group. So there's HOTS. And this is I can't remember the name of it. I was going to say PTSA, paratoluyl sulfonic acid. There we go. It's YL, toluyl sulfonic acid. We usually write it PTSA is another way that it's abbreviated instead of HOTS. So there's many different abbreviations that can be used for that. It looks like sulfuric acid, and it actually is very, very strong. It's an organic acid as opposed to an aqueous acid, and it's soluble in organic solvents and is really used quite a bit for protonating in organic reactions. So as an acid in organic reactions. We can also see that one more reaction I'll give you. We can react alcohols using HBr or HCl, and these can undergo substitution reactions as well to replace the alcohol with the halogen. The byproduct here would be water. So there's a bunch of different examples, or three different examples, of what we can see in terms of SN1 reactions. Note that each one of these SN1 reactions, as I go through and I look at this center here, that this is a tertiary center. tertiary alkyl halide, and that the leaving group is the chloride. We can look at this one where the leaving group is the tosylate. That's also a tertiary center. And we can look at this guy here where the leaving group is the hydroxyl. And this is also a tertiary center. That all of these examples that I've shown you of SN1 reactions have tertiary centers. And that goes back to this idea or this concept that tertiary is much faster than secondary, is much faster than primary. It's not to say that we can't do an SN1 reaction on a secondary substrate, but we do see primarily a lot with tertiary substrates. Okay. These SN1 reactions, for certain SN1 reactions, we give them a name and we call them a sulfolysis reaction. Sulfolysis means replacement by solvent. And these replacement by solvent, these are SN1 reactions. All sulfolysis reactions are SN1 reactions. In this case, we're going to look at a specific sulfolysis reaction. So we are going to look at a reaction where I am taking a tertiary chloride and reacting it in methanol and some heat. And this is going to become tertiary butyl methyl ether. And the byproduct will be HCl. The mechanism for this reaction, so this is just an example reaction that we're going to look at. And the example here, I guess what I would say is, here is the solvent. I use green for leaving group. Let's use something else. Here's the solvent, and here's where that solvent has replaced it, replacement by solvent. So there is our SN1 reaction. The mechanism for this reaction. We'll write that mechanism out, and then we'll put it into an energy diagram. First thing that happens is we have dissociation. This is a loss of leaving group. It happens spontaneously, and this is unimolecular. You can think about this bond as the way that I like to think about it is that the substrate, the carbon molecule, is a ping pong paddle. The chlorine is a ping pong ball, and this is a string that is attaching the two. And that if you're sitting there and you're using the paddle and you're hitting the ball, and we keep hitting the ball, as long as we hit the ball with a small amount of force, the string is intact and the bond just keeps stretching and vibrating, right? And the ball comes back and hits the paddle and we play the paddle game. But if I turn up the heat, and that's what the symbol here is, if I turn up the heat, then it's like hitting this with more and more force, increasing force. Eventually I hit it with so much force that the bond cannot be sustained. And the string breaks, and the chloride comes free of the substrate. And that's what happens, is that as I turn up the heat, this is my slow rate determining step. And it leads to a carbocation, which is trigonal planar, and it leads to the loss of the chloride ion. Now, methanol is sitting in the solution. It is the solvent. I'm going to leave the methanol just as an open bond here, meaning that that's a CH3 group rather than writing in the whole CH3, because that makes it a little bit harder to see what's going on. The less things that we draw here, probably the better. The methanol uses its lone pairs on the oxygen to attack the carbocation, making a new bond with the carbocation. The carbocation then becomes tetrahedral, The oxygen is bound to it. And now the oxygen takes on the positive charge. The chloride ion acts as a base, removes the acidic proton, giving the electrons back to the oxygen, and the reaction is concluded. So there's our overall reaction. So this is the nucleophilic attack step. And this is a proton transfer step. Okay, energy diagram wise, what does this look like? Let's put this whole thing into an energy diagram. This has to be a slightly larger energy diagram in order to accommodate the whole thing. And we have multiple steps that we need to accommodate. So an energy diagram doesn't have to be for a single reaction. An energy diagram can be a multi-step energy diagram. The first thing that we start off with is an energy that is relatively, let's put it right about here. This is my tertiary butyl chloride and my methanol that is sitting in solution. And the first step is the chloride comes off. When the chloride comes off, this goes into the transition state, or it goes through the transition state and into the intermediate, where the intermediate is the carbocation. Carbocations are very high in energy. And so we have a very large energy hill that we need to climb. Let's say that that energy hill places us right about here. So I've got to come through, tag onto that guy. And there's our activation energy for that step. Once I'm at the carbocation, the nucleophilic attack is the fast step. That then takes me down to something that is relatively low in energy. This is where I have the tetrahedral carbon, the oxygen, and the oxygen now has a positive charge on it. And then this step's a little bit confusing and needs some explaining. This one comes back up in energy and goes where the chloride takes the proton, giving the electrons back to, I didn't quite get my arrow right there, giving the electrons back to the oxygen. And the reaction is now concluded. So why did we come back up in energy? Why did we not stop at the lowest possible energy? And the answer is because this isn't really how these reactions go in practice. HCl is a very strong acid. The hydrogen connected to the chloride is higher in energy than the hydrogen connected to the oxygen. If I look at these acids, HCl is the stronger acid than the oxygen, the protonated oxygen, the oxonium ion. So why then would the chloride take the proton to go to this step if this is a higher energy step? And the answer is it doesn't really. In practice, most of it would stay down here until we added a base to it or something to be able to deprotonate this species. Or oftentimes, instead of trying to do a reaction this way, where I just use methanol, I would sometimes put a base in here along with this. Or I could see that perhaps another methanol would be deprotonate this, go into the final product, and I wouldn't really end up with HCl as much as I would end up with other protonated methanols that would be about the same amount of energy leading me to my final product over there. But this is the way that we most often represent it because all those other things are confusing the issue. So we deal with this just being slightly higher in energy. This is our rate determining step. And this is where our focus is going to be, is over here, trying to get this rate determining step under control and understanding what that actually looks like. It's supposed to be a D, come on. Here we go. So I really want to know, what does that guy look like? That rate determining step, if I look at it, and the transition state, looks like this. Where the chloride is coming off, this is partial minus, and this is partial positive. That's my transition state. And if I want to go back and I want to look at this, and I want to use Hammond postulate, and I want to say, what does that transition state look like? Well, I have to ask, is it more closely related to the carbocation, or is it more closely related to the alkyl halide? And of course, it's most closely related to whichever side it's closest in energy to. So we're a lot closer in energy to the carbocation, which means that this transition state is going to be carbocation-like. So this is the part that I need to focus on, is I need to ask myself about carbocations. And I need to understand carbocations in order to be able to understand this transition state. So we'll say, must look at carbocation stability to understand SN1. All right, so carbocation stability, we haven't looked at a whole lot. I had you do a little bit, I think, with the carbocation stability in one of the co-ops that we looked at. We're going to revisit that information now. So let's take a look at carbocation stability and see what we can gain from this. In carbocation stability, what we find is that carbocations increase in their stability in going from methyl being the least stable. And then I'm going to choose a substrate that has all the different possible carbocations that I could draw. So this would be a primary carbocation, a secondary carbocation, and finally a tertiary carbocation. And what we find is that if we measure these carbocation stabilities, that we are increasing in stability in going from methyl to primary to secondary to tertiary. With this tertiary being the most stable. With a caveat, tertiary is the most stable if we're just looking at primary versus secondary versus tertiary. There are things that are more stable than a tertiary carbocation, which we will get to, which makes rather interesting. So the question then is why? Why is it that a tertiary is the most stable carbocation, and then secondary, and then primary? What's actually going on here? This has to do with alkyl groups being electron donating. Remember that an alkyl group is an electron donating group. So if we remember that an alkyl group is an electron donating group, then when we take a look at the carbocation and we take a look at a primary, there is one electron donating group. Let me do it in blue, I'll do it in a different color here. There is one electron donating group that is sending electron density towards that primary carbocation. When I look at a secondary carbocation has twice the amount of electron donating groups. So I have an electron donating group here, which is sending electron density to that carbocation, and I have an electron donating group here, which is sending electron density to that carbocation. And then when I look at a tertiary, it's got three electron donating groups on it. The more electron donating groups there are, the greater the positive charge is delocalized, and the more stable the carbocation becomes. So I have 1, 2, and 3 electron donating groups pushing electron density towards that carbocation. And that is a stabilizing factor. So primary carbocation, secondary carbocation, tertiary carbocation, most stabilizing forces. Based on the amount of donation. Yet we could ask why, what is that donation? How does that donation work? How is an alkyl group electron donating? We haven't really asked that question before. And that's an important question that we should answer. And there's two different models that I can show for that. So the two different models, the first one is called hyperconjugation. In hyperconjugation, what we do is we take a look at the carbocation and the adjacent alkyl group. The carbocation has an empty p orbital. And when I take a look at the adjacent alkyl group, the adjacent alkyl group is tetrahedral. These could be carbon-hydrogen bonds or carbon-carbon bonds. In any regard, they're a sigma bond. And the sigma bond has its electron density that looks like this in the center in the orbital here. So what I have is I have my empty p orbital. This empty p orbital sits and resides, and we'll use the color scheme that indicates that this is empty. The other one is an orbital which has electron density in it. And what I'm getting is I'm getting donation from the sigma bond and overlap into the empty p orbital. This is the sigma bond. So I'm getting sigma bond to p orbital overlap. That overlap is donation, electron donation. And that electron donation helps to stabilize the empty p orbital. It helps to give electron density to the carbocation that decreases the carbocation charge. So this is coming out of valence bonding theory. Just a second, I have a disconnect between my Apple Pencil and my iPad. I decided that they did not want to be paired anymore. Nope, dead in the water. What happens when an Apple Pencil dies? You can't reconnect it. It says Apple Pencil, but not giving me. All right, hold on. Time out. I'm gonna reboot the iPad real quick. See if I can get it to come back up. I've never had that happen with this iPad before. Ah, we were just at a critical moment too with hyperconjugation. The next part is we look at molecular orbital theory and an explanation for molecular orbital theory. Oh, this is not good. The iPad does not want to reboot either. Maybe. It's just go from there. There, now we're rebooting. Let me stop the screen share for a second, too. Let's get back up. Fortunately, iPads reboot way faster than computers. And we're working again. Okay. So there was my valence bonding theory. Let's put that up against molecular orbital theory. So I'm going to slide this over just a little bit and we'll give a molecular orbital theory picture. In molecular orbital theory, what we find is that when we look at this picture and we look at the carbocation, underneath, the framework looks exactly the same. We have exactly the same, I'm going to put the carbocation over there too. Exactly the same picture here, except for what the molecular orbital looks like. And the molecular orbital, when we look at the molecular orbital, the one that we're interested in is what the LUMO looks like. So we're going to look at the LUMO orbital, the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. And what we see with that LUMO is that the shape of the LUMO takes and puts some electron density over the carbocation, and then a lot of electron density over the carbon here, and it is symmetrical top and bottom. Looks like that. And that this is the LUMO, so this is the unoccupied orbital. And if I had to ask, what is this LUMO actually doing? Green. If I had to ask, what is this LUMO actually doing, or what does it look like it's doing? It looks like it's spread over the adjacent carbon and over the carbocation. And it looks as though I'm taking what was an orbital here and spreading it over the carbocation. And it looks kind of like a pi bond. In fact, it's pi bond-like. And what this is electron donation to the carbocation. From adjacent alkyl group. So regardless of which theory I look at, I can see that I get a little bit of donation here too, and these two overlapping. Regardless of which theory I look at, either hyperconjugation or molecular orbital theory, both theories indicate that an adjacent alkyl group uses its electron density to support the empty valence of the carbocation. And that the more alkyl groups I have, the more donation I have. In addition to that, what this is showing is it doesn't matter how big the alkyl side chain is, because the donation is coming primarily from either the sigma bond or at least the first carbon that is there and does not extend to adjacent carbons. And so it doesn't matter how long the alkyl group is, the size of the alkyl group is irrelevant. It is just the nature of an alkyl group that an alkyl group is electron donating. So we could say that a methyl versus an ethyl versus a propyl or a butyl, they all are equally electron donating. And I don't get more electron donation from a larger group or a longer group. So size of the group is completely irrelevant. That's an important aspect. Now, Hammond postulate. When we go back to the Hammond postulate and we look at what's going on with this carbocation, so let's take a look back at Hammond for a second. Hammond postulate is telling me that when I look at our leaving group, and that our leaving group, the leaving group coming off and going to the carbocation, sometimes it wants to snap in and sometimes it doesn't. Ah, okay, forget you. No, it doesn't want to do it at all now. There we go. Oh, but that is just so wrong. And my need for precision is so wrong. Okay, so this is the carbocation. That as I look at that carbocation, and I try to figure out what's going on with Hammond, anything that changes the energy of this side of the carbocation will also increase the energy of that transition state. And so the transition state energy is linked to the carbocation energy. Transition state energy, that's nice, thank you. Transition state energy over all of my years, over 22 years of teaching, that one word that trips me up continuously is transition state. Trying to say that fast in a lecture constantly has always tripped me up. Transition state energy, I just need to slow down and enunciate. Transition state energy is linked to carbocation stability. In other words, what happens is when I look at a carbocation, and let's do the carbocation first that is tertiary. If I look at a tertiary carbocation or the formation of that tertiary carbocation, and I look at that leaving group, let's do it this way. Let's put the leaving group on there first. And I'll do it in an energy diagram. So that what I'm doing is I'm going from that carbocation leaving group to the energy there. So there's my carbocation or my leaving group. Here is my full carbocation. There is my transition state. That this activation energy is the smallest when that's a tertiary carbocation. That when I change and look at going to a secondary leaving group, the energy of the starting material is really unchanged. And so my starting point is really the same point that I was here. But what happens is I'm going to a much higher energy carbocation. I'm going to a secondary carbocation. And because that secondary carbocation is higher in energy than the tertiary, it increases the transition state with us. So as I was doing before, I could try to maybe grab this guy, copy it, paste it over here, and then let's style it this way. That the idea is that I have increased in energy from that tertiary carbocation state. And correspondingly, it has increased my activation energy. When I go to a primary, it happens to an even greater degree. The energy of the primary substrate does not change. But what does change is when that group comes off, I go to a very high energy state, looking at a primary carbocation. And that I have now dramatically increased my energy for my transition state and my activation energy. And so the rates of these chemical reactions are that this reaction is a lot faster for a tertiary substrate than it is for a secondary substrate than it is for a tertiary substrate or primary substrate. So the rate for this chemical reaction, if I want to write this out rate-wise, what we see is that rate is equal to the rate constant times the concentration of our leaving group, and that the equilibrium or the rate constant here is proportional to the activation energy, E sub A, and that that guy is equal to some equilibrium constant times E to the minus delta G double dagger over RT, and that this is equal to K naught E minus E sub A over RT. And there is where that activation energy comes in. Because delta G is equal to, delta G double dagger is equal to the activation energy E sub A. And there's my dependence on that. So that's how that activation energy really plays into that rate, is that the activation energy is part of the rate law, essentially, that is baked into that rate constant K. And so that's where it actually affects it. So let's put some of these things into practice. Let's look at a couple of chemical reactions. Let's see if we can ask a question. Which reaction is faster? Let's do this group reacting with methanol. So this is an SN1. This is a sevolysis, methanol and heat. And we're going to form a product that is going to have the solvent replacing it. And the other one, I will put the chloride on a different position in the substrate. This is the same reaction conditions, methanol and heat, going to form the analogous product. So I want to ask, which one of these two chemical reactions would I expect to be faster? Both the same in terms of mechanism, but which one would I assume to be faster? So to answer the question, what we need to do is we need to look at the mechanism a little bit. This guy comes off, it gives me a carbocation here, and then the methanol is going to come in and attack that. And then I will have a deprotonation step where the methanol proton is taken by the chloride. And then that's going to kick me around to that product. And the other one here, I have the chloride kicking off. Basically, we have all the same steps. We have the carbocation that forms. The methanol comes in and attacks it. I'm going to connect my methanol down at this point for consistency with my product. The chloride takes the proton. We come around to the product. So let me give a little bit of distance between these two reactions. They're kind of mushing together. And I want to ask which of these is the faster chemical reaction? And what would I predict to be faster? Well, what I would do is I would focus in on this step. I'm looking at the fact that this one here is secondary, and the fact that this one is tertiary. And what most people would say is that most people would say, well, the tertiary is faster. They would go here and they would say faster, because everything that I just set you up for, looking at all of these rates, said that the tertiary was the fastest rate because it's going to have the lowest activation energy. But remember what I really said. What I really said was that anything that affects the energy of this position over here, either raising or lowering it, is going to do the same thing to the transition state. So when we come back over here and we look, this is really not certain yet. Because what I have said is that when we look at a chemical reaction, this way, when I look at the chemical reaction, and I'm looking at the carbocation, and this is the C plus, and this is my activation energy, that anything that lowers this energy will lower this, and this will become a faster chemical reaction. Anything that increases this energy will increase the transition state, and this will be slower. So now we come back and we look at those carbocations, and we have to ask which carbocation is more stable. That's really the question that we're asking. So in that, what we're asking is which one of these carbocations, I want to draw it the same way, and I flipped it over. Which one of these carbocations is more stable? Well, what we haven't done is we haven't done our due diligence in looking at these carbocations. Yes, this one is tertiary, and this one is secondary. However, this one has something that the other one doesn't. This is secondary with resonance. And we know that resonance is one of the main stabilizing features. In fact, resonance is a more stabilizing factor than induction. And when we're looking at these alkyl groups and we're looking at primary versus secondary versus tertiary, we're primarily looking at induction. So remember that in terms of our factors, the factors that we had for stability, stability was governed by electronegativity, hybridization. This is going back to the acid-base chapter. Resonance, size, and then induction. As electronegativity is more important. And that means that resonance is a greater factor than induction. And so what we would predict is that we would predict that the secondary with resonance is going to be more stable than a tertiary without. And so what I did is, in this question, I set you up to say that the tertiary is faster. Because what I wanted to do was to remind you that there are lots of other things that affect stability. And that even though we're moving on in material, and even though the book may focus on primary versus secondary versus tertiary, resonance is a major key factor in everything that we do moving forward. And you cannot forget anything that we studied previously, that all of that material is still in play, still absolutely required, and that it's not as simple as primary versus secondary versus tertiary, that we could add into that primary versus secondary versus tertiary with resonance, and that resonance can be a factor that plays into all of this as well. So that acid-based chapter was incredibly important, and you cannot forget that acid-based chapter. All right, so what we're seeing here then is that if we look at these in terms of energy diagrams, where both of these substrates may be approximately at the same level, that when this group comes off and goes to the carbocation, and I'm drawing these guys here at the same level, that as I go to the carbocation, this carbocation may be, maybe let's put this a little higher. I was just gonna see if it would snap in, but it's not going to. Oh, maybe it is. This carbocation at a little bit higher spot. This is the tertiary carbocation. And the activation energy for that step. And then at this guy over here, is that this is a resonance stabilized carbocation and has lower activation energy. And that the lower activation energy is telling me about the rate of the chemical reaction. And that this is the faster reaction. Because the lower E sub A. This is an important thing too that I want to say real quick, that when I'm asking you for an answer and I want to know why one reaction is faster than another, it is not adequate to tell me that it is a primary versus secondary versus tertiary or even resonance. That primary versus secondary versus tertiary, that all of that stuff goes back to the activation energy. And that the activation energy is what I'm really after there, because the activation energy is what is affecting the rate of the chemical reaction. So it really needs to go back to the activation energy. All right, I did not have the chat open. I'm looking back at the chat. Tert is faster for SN1 reactions compared to secondary. So, yeah, I actually caught you in the chat a little bit, exactly what I was setting up to do for that chemical reaction. But I think that this highlights exactly what I wanted it to highlight. And it makes an impression in terms of looking at this chemical reaction. Oh, by the way, going back to this, this carbocation, secondary with resonance, this carbocation is what's called an allylic carbocation. So there's a term that I didn't hit yet. I did talk about allylic chlorides, allylic alcohols. I talked about the allylic position. We could also refer to it in terms of a carbocation, an allylic carbocation, meaning that a carbocation that is one bond away from a double bond. And that is a way of referring to something that has resonance, an allylic carbocation. All right, let me ask maybe one more thing. Let's take one more second and do one more little thing here. Let's do another one. Which one is faster? And there is lots to be gained in looking at just these little tests. Races, we can call them, which reaction is faster. There's lots of information to be gained from these. So let's take and do a substrate where I have a chlorine here. This time what I'll do is I'll make these CF3 groups and methanol and heat. And we'll go to, again, making the ether. I'll put in my CF3 groups. And in the second substrate, we'll move the chlorine. Let's put the chlorine in this position. Again, methanol, heat, and we're making the analogous product. These are, again, both SN1 reactions. So we're looking at an SN1 mechanism. So if we're looking at an SN1 mechanism, then we need to compare the carbocations and we need to ask which carbocation is more stable. Notice that no matter which question I ask you, it seems like no matter what chapter we're in, the question that I ask is not really the question you need to answer. There's always some other question you need to answer in order to answer my question. You need to go 2, 3, 4 layers deep, and the layers keep getting deeper every time in order to answer the question that I want answered, which reaction is faster. To answer which reaction is faster, I need to look at the carbocations because this is an SN1 reaction. So I need to go through and I need to compare each of the carbocations in these reactions. So let's drop this one down just a little bit and let's go to that carbocation, pop this guy off, go to the carbocation, and we say, all right, which of these carbocations then, that is the wrong carbocation, gotta make sure you draw it right. That carbocation versus this guy coming off and this carbocation. So now my question really is, which carbocation is more stable? And so I'm comparing these two. Well, if you just run down the line and you compare them, then what you find is that this guy is secondary and this guy is tertiary. But what are these big groups doing? What are these CF3 groups? These are strong electron withdrawing groups. So in that these are strong electron withdrawing groups, these guys are sucking electron density out away. And these are very strong electron withdrawing groups. So remember that induction with electron withdrawing groups falls off with distance. These two electron withdrawing groups are farther away from the carbocation. That means that they're going to have less of an effect. These, the electron withdrawing groups, are closer. This is going to be less stable. If this is less stable, what's happening here is the carbocation is increasing in energy. And therefore, as I look at the energy of this thing, the transition state is also increasing. This is going to increase the activation energy, the E sub A. This is going to have a higher E sub A. Slower reaction. This one is going to have the lower E sub A. and the faster reaction. So which reaction was going to be faster? The reaction that's going to be faster was going to be this guy. Blurry E sub A. More stable. C plus. All right, so lots to go over. We have some more things. Let me see, I'm just looking forward just to see kind of where we're going yet. We have a couple of curveballs coming up in the next lecture. So we start looking at alkyl shifts and hydride shifts and changes of one carbocation for a more stable carbocation and how we can get framework changes based on alkyl shifts and hydride shifts. So the next curveball comes into this, but we've hit the beginning part, SN1 and SN2. We have a little bit more to do with SN1 because carbocations are so unstable that carbocations can oftentimes rearrange. And so we need to look at how those rearrangements play into these SN1 reactions and predicting the products of SN1 reactions. So lots more good stuff to come in this chapter. This is a large chapter. It's going to take us a little bit of time to go through. That is not to say that you should wait until we are done before you start exploring this chapter and doing the homework problems in this chapter. You should follow through and be doing and working in the OChem as a Second Language book and doing the SN1 and SN2 problem sets that are in there as we're going through and doing this, doing the same within the textbook. So don't forget about those and staying up with things. All right, I'm going to cut the lecture there and I'll see you guys in lab for tomorrow. And I'll see you back here again for lecture on Thursday. All right, thanks a lot. Take care, guys.